Hi, this is Millie Long, co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Gastroenterology, and I'm thrilled to have a guest with us today who's going to teach us a lot about high-risk colon cancer syndromes. So Jenny Marat from IU is here with us. So welcome to the program, Jenny.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, so Jenny, let's start off. I'd love to have you introduce yourself to our audience because you really have a unique area of interest in the work you do. So can you tell us a little bit about your high-risk practice?
Absolutely. So I'm a gastroenterologist at Indiana University, and I also work at the Rauterbusch VA Medical Center in Indianapolis. I co-lead with our genetics colleagues the Inherited Colorectal Cancer Syndromes Clinic at IU. And through this clinic, what we did is we launched it as a multidisciplinary clinic. So we have myself as a gastroenterologist, and we have a whole cohort of genetics leaders, so a geneticist, a genetic counselor, as well as a nurse navigator. We work very closely with our colleagues in advanced endoscopy, as well as colorectal surgeons, gynecologists, oncologists. And we really have a really great network of providers that are familiar with patients that have hereditary colorectal cancer syndromes. Their care can be quite complex and nuanced, and the decision-making can involve multiple providers. So we've formed a great network of providers here at IU to take care of these patients.
It's a great model for care, and I would venture to guess that other academic sites may have a similar model. And I recognize that a lot of our listeners are likely in practice, but I think that this hopefully will be a really nice conversation to identify those patients who are at need of seeing someone like you kind of in such a high-risk scenario. And the article you wrote in Red Journal this month really was a fantastic practical review article on exactly this, the idea of these high-risk colon cancer syndromes. Can you tell us a little bit about the article you wrote in terms of a summary?
Absolutely. So the article that we've wrote is focused on adenomatous polyposis coli, or the APC gene, and specifically polyposis-related syndromes. As a gastroenterologist, we commonly hear about and are very familiar with familial adenomatous polyposis, or FAP, which is the most common APC gene-related polyposis syndrome. But there are others that we've come to know about over the course of the years that we've highlighted. And I think it's important as gastroenterologists to note, when you may think about a patient having those other syndromes that are related to these APC genes. So we did kind of a broad overview of the APC gene, as well as the genotype-phenotype correlations, and then dove into the diagnostic and management considerations for these syndromes.
No, that's great. And I think, as a gastroenterologist myself who does screening colonoscopy, it's helpful to know when you find something such as numerous polyps, what are the next steps? And let's start with kind of the risk factors or some of the epidemiology of these APC gene-related polyposis syndromes. How common are these? And tell us a little bit about, is there an age or a gender that we may, as we're scoping, be more likely to find these syndromes?
So when we think about the APC gene-related syndromes, I really want to highlight two syndromes. So we have, on the one hand, FAP, or familial adenomatous polyposis. There's a classic form and an attenuated form, and the difference really being in the colorectal polyp burden. So in the classic form, you may see hundreds of polyps, up to thousands of polyps in some of these patients, whereas in the attenuated form, it's typically a lower polyp burden, less than 100 colorectal polyps. And these are cumulative or lifetime polyps. Most commonly, these are adenomas. The prevalence of FAP is estimated to 1 in 6,000 to roughly 1 in 30,000. It occurs in men and women at equal rates, and there's really no phenotypic differences we know across ethnicities or ethnic groups in the U.S. The typical age of presentation for FAP patients is typically in the teen or young adult years. The second syndrome that I think about for APC gene-related polyposis syndromes was more recently recognized, actually in 2012. It was reported by Worthy and colleagues, and that's gastric adenocarcinoma and proximal polyposis of the stomach, or GAPS, as we refer to it. The true prevalence has yet to be determined for GAPS. This is a syndrome in contrast to FAP, where we see polyposis involving the stomach, the proximal part of the stomach, rather than the duodenum or the colon or rectum. The genetic cause differs between GAPS and FAP. So the underlying genotype that we see in GAPS is actually a single nucleotide variant in the APC promoter 1B region, which contrasts to the larger deletions and variations in the APC gene that we see classically in FAP. The onset of patients with GAPS is a little bit older, typically in the 30s to 50s, though earlier cases have absolutely been reported, and we recommend screening by way of upper endoscopy at a young age in the teens, actually, for GAPS.
Oh, that's really interesting. So how typically are these two that we just discussed diagnosed? Obviously, many people have a family history, but that may not be recognized. Talk us through the diagnosis strategy.
Yeah, so the diagnosis is based on either clinical suspicion. So if you're doing endoscopy, upper endoscopy, and you see a lot of polyps in the stomach, you have to think a little bit about, could there be an underlying hereditary cause for the polyposis that's in the stomach or in the duodenum? Same with the colonoscopy. So if you're doing a colonoscopy in somebody, especially at younger ages, and typically we're doing those colonoscopies for diagnostic purposes, for symptoms, perhaps signs like iron deficiency anemia, or they may say, you know, they have a family history of young onset of colorectal cancer. Those are the patients where you have to start thinking about this. And polyposis, or colorectal polyposis, is really defined when we think about adenomas as at least 10 cumulative or lifetime adenomas in a patient. And we know many of our patients actually meet that threshold. Interestingly, what you see, what studies show, is that the higher the polyp burden, really getting up into 10, upwards of 20 colorectal adenomas, is when we see that the yield of genetic testing actually increases. And we see these hereditary colorectal cancer syndromes arise.
Right. So it's kind of putting it all together, right? Like the individual risk factors, the age, because by age 70, someone may have had three adenomas each on various colonoscopies. That would not be a likely candidate. But putting together the individual factors and understanding the polyp burden and the type of prior polyps, which can also be a challenge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's different polyposis syndromes, and this article is really limited to the APC gene-related polyposis syndromes where we see adenomas, but there are other polyposis syndromes that we as gastroenterologists need to be mindful of, including serrated polyposis syndrome as well as hamartomatous polyposis syndromes.
And there's less data surrounding some of those, too, in terms of next steps,
yes,
which can obviously
exactly.
be a challenge for us as endoscopists. Well, let me ask you a question about FAP, because that is probably the one that sticks in my head the most, is the one that I, you know, have been trained on and educated about. But I think one of the things I learned from your article is I think I wasn't aware of all of the extra-intestinal manifestations of FAP. Would you mind reviewing that with our audience? Because I think that's nice to have in the back of your mind as you see these polyps to kind of think, what about these extraintestinal things? Does this patient have evidence of any of these?
Yes, there are quite a few extraintestinal manifestations that we've highlighted in the article. And many of those actually most commonly involve the skin, bones, teeth. So in terms of the skin, patients may have, you know, epidermoid cysts, lipomas, pyelometricomas, which are just benign growths of the hair follicles that present as nodules. It can be very subtle. In the general population, bony growths, so osteomas, are common, typically involving the mandible. They may have dental findings, so supernumerary teeth or absence of teeth. All of these features of the skin, bones, and teeth, I use more to, you know, determine on the initial visit, you know, how likely is it that we're going to find an APC gene-related polyposis syndrome like FAP. FAP is where you see these extraintestinal manifestations. So, you know, these by themselves are not diagnostic, however. There are a few extraintestinal manifestations that, as gastroenterologists, we should be aware of, you know, when we're thinking about patients that could have FAP, or you may consider doing a colonoscopy on to see if they have colorectal polyposis and meet clinical criteria. And those are really a few. So a patient with desmoid disease, for example, desmoids are fibroblast proliferations. They often develop in the mesentery of the abdominal wall, but they can occur in the chest wall or in the extremities. They're benign growths, but they can be locally infiltrative and aggressive. They don't have metastatic potential necessarily, but just more local infiltration. And they can cause mass effect. For example, if there's an abdominal wall desmoid tumor, the patient may present with a recurrent abdominal or small bowel obstructions, for example. So if you see somebody that has had these desmoid tumors, you want to think about whether they could be associated with an APC gene variant, linking them to FAP. The other manifestations in the extraintestinal forms are to think about are specific types of thyroid cancer. So the Kribber form, Morular type, is a specific variant that's very rare in the general population, but more associated with APC gene variants. So that's one that may trigger you to think about whether the patient could have an APC gene variant. And then the final one that I think about is what we call CHRPE, or congenital hypertrophy of the retinal epithelium. These are described as flat pigmented spots on the retina, and they're seen during an eye exam, typically the retina, of course. And solitary lesions occur in 1 to 2% of the general population, and those aren't the patients that I'm really focused on. But if you've seen their past medical history or their report to you that they may have these that are multifocal or bilateral, that's when you think about, could there be an APC gene variant? Again, these are pretty specific extraintestinal manifestations that we as gastroenterologists may not be looking for, but somebody may report a history of these manifestations, and then that should, you know, have you think about whether there could be an APC gene variant.
That's really interesting. I didn't know about the eye findings. Do you receive some referrals from ophthalmologists to your?
I have, yes, I absolutely have, and it is known in the ophthalmologic literature too. You know, these are reported. They call them bear tracks, is what I've come to find out in the retina. So yeah.
Oh, that's a new one. That's really interesting. And it's specific enough, it sounds like. Do you then, go ahead and order genetic testing on those individuals, or start with the colonoscopy?
So you start with the colonoscopy, and then also, of course, get the family history and other, see if they have other manifestations that may be consistent and suggestive.
Yeah, that's interesting. So again, as gastroenterologists, we do have to think systemically, of course.
Absolutely.
So one last question, again, focusing on FAP, which I think we're probably a little bit more familiar with, but I thought you had a nice table, and I'd like to direct our readers to the table in your paper, but it really summarized the chemoprevention trials associated with APC gene-related polyposis syndromes. And I have to admit, a little bit disappointing in terms of a lot of the chemoprevention trials, but just practically in your practice, how do you use chemoprevention?
Great question. So there have been, as you can see in our table, many trials related to chemoprevention. Among the medications that have been most studied are actually the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, you know, and the other medications have been studied either as, you know, using NSAIDs as a comparator or combined with the NSAIDs or alone. And there's a lot of trials underway as we speak, and there's promising data that will be coming forthcoming. Actually, I'd encourage listeners to also keep an eye out for the forthcoming American College of Gastroenterology guidelines on the diagnosis and management of adenomatous polyposis syndromes led by Dr. Carol Burke, who will highlight many of those chemoprevention studies as well and recommendations. But ultimately, you know, the bottom line is that chemoprevention can't be used to replace your endoscopic or surgical management, but it can be used as an adjunct. So where I think about using chemoprevention is in a patient that has perhaps already undergone a colectomy and they underwent an ileorectal anastomosis. So they do have part of their rectum intact, and you're still performing endoscopic surveillance every, you know, 6 to 12 months postoperatively. But you're starting to see that their polyp burden in the remaining rectum is starting to going up. So in terms of the number of adenomas or the features of the adenomas becoming more advanced, that's somebody where I might think about chemoprevention, because what you're trying to do is see if you can reduce and regress some of the adenomas and prevent them or perhaps delay slightly for them, you know, having to undergo another surgery, which can have, you know, high morbidity and, of course, impact quality of life at that point. So the tricky part is, you know, Sulindac at 150 milligrams taken twice daily is the one that I will typically reach for in those scenarios if the patient can tolerate it and, you know, kidney disease isn't an issue, for example. The tricky part is even with polyp regression, we don't know that these medications like Sulindac prevents the you know, subsequent cancer occurrence. We have seen polyps regress or flatten per se, you know, if you think of it when you're looking at it endoscopically, but they've gone on to develop cancer. So they still need sort of close surveillance, and it certainly shouldn't replace your endoscopic or surgical management, but can be, like I mentioned earlier, used as an adjunct.
That's a great take-home point, that the endoscopic and surgical management is really key here, and that we're not at a point where it's true chemo prevention. So I think that's a huge take-home point for our audience. And thank you for highlighting the fact that we will have an upcoming guideline in American Journal of Gastroenterology that hopefully will help with some specific scenarios and recommendations, you know, in this arena. We really appreciate your time and teaching us today. So Dr. Jenny Marat from IU, we're thrilled to have you. Thanks for joining our program.
Thank you so much for having me. And I just like to make a quick shout out to my collaborators on this manuscript. Dr. Jen Weiss was instrumental in, you know, drafting the manuscript and strategically thinking about the topic. Annalise Fry, also from University of Wisconsin, was instrumental. So I really thank their collaboration and help with this piece of work.
Thanks to you and your team.
Thank you so much.